This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, professor of television studies at Rowan University in New Jersey, sitting in for Terry Gross. This year marks the 50th anniversary of Philadelphia International Records, known for the Philly sound of the 1960s and 70s. Earlier this week, we listened back to our interview with record label founders Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. Now, we'll hear from one of the principal architects of the Philly sound, songwriter, arranger, and producer Tom Bell. He arranged Joe Simon's Drowning in the Sea of Love and Backstabbers by the OJs. Before that, he worked with the Philadelphia label Cameo Records. He co-wrote the Stylistics hits You Are Everything, Betcha by Golly Wow, Break Up to Make Up, and You Make Me Feel Brand New. For the Spinners, he co-composed I'll Be Around. When Bell was a teenager, he conducted and arranged for fellow Philadelphian Chubby Checker, whose dance records included the number one hit, The Twist. Bell was born in Jamaica and moved to Philly as a child. He now lives in Washington State. Last year, a compilation album of Bell's work, Ready or Not, Philly Soul Arrangements and Productions, was released by Ace Records. Bell has been inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame and received the Rhythm and Blues Foundation Pioneer Award. Terry Gross spoke with Tom Bell in 2006. Let's start with a song he co-wrote for the Delphonics. La La Means I Love You.
Many guys have come to you with a line that wasn't true, and you passed them by.
Passed them by.
Though you're in the center ring, and their lines don't mean a thing, why don't you let me try?
Let me try.
Now I don't wear a diamond ring. I don't even know a song to sing. All I know is la 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 la. I love you. Oh, baby, please now. La 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 la. I love you.
If I ever saw a girl that I needed in this world, you are the one. For me.
That's the Delphonics, recorded in 1968, produced, arranged, and co-written by my guest Tom Bell.
And conducted,
thank you. Tom Bell, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you, we appreciate being here.
Well, we just heard one of your early hits. Would you talk a little bit about your concept for that record, La La Means I Love You?
I've always, because I was studying to be a concert pianist, from the time I was 6 until I was 22.
You're talking about classical music.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I was studying to be. I worked with Andre Watts at the time.
Really?
Which was, as you know, the number one, not only the black pianist, but a concert pianist, period.
And one of the few African-American,
right,
very successful,
right,
classical and musicians of his generation.
When we were kids, we should do, in those days, they were called recitals. Now they're called concerts. We do our little, play our little things and our little prelude in C sharp and play Chopin and different things like that. And by the time I was 18, I found that articulating someone else's music was not quite what I wanted to do. There are people who can articulate it and articulate it well. I got bored with that. They keep playing the same thing over and over and over and over again. And 3 hours, 4 hours a day from the time I was 6, 8, 10, 12 years of age, keep doing the same thing over new pieces, but you keep doing everything to perfect it. When is it perfected? Is it perfected when you don't make mistakes? Is it perfected when you have the tonality correctly? Is it perfected when you have the fingering correct? So I was hearing different chords, different progressions, different variations of the themes of what I was doing, and I started doing that. But you can't really do that with the master's creations. So the question you asked me about what sound was I looking for, and different, it was a sound in my mind, because of the classical background in which I had come from, I was hearing things more like that, because until I was about 13 or 14 years of age, I didn't even listen to radio. I never heard the so-called rock and roll, so-called. So
you didn't know pop music, you didn't know soul music.
No, what I heard,
rhythm and blues.
What I heard was strictly coming from the symphonic end.
So you kind of brought both.
I did.
You know,
I brought
you had
all
strings
of
and harps.
Brought all those things from what I had come from, the world I had come from.
Mm-hmm.
And that the very first thing I heard that really made me believe what I was hearing was fantastic was a guy named Don Costa. Don Costa was a fantastic arranger. I heard him. He arranged Going Out of My Head with Little Anthony and the Imperials.
Oh, did he do that? He's most famous for his Sinatra arrangements.
And Teddy Randazzo was the writer. He and I think Weinstein, I believe that was his name. But I always remember Teddy Randazzo because I met him once, and that was the highlight of my life. And I'm going out of my head on the outside looking in. And that's when I was really turned on to hearing what I was hearing. That's why you hear the Delphonics have that tenor voice. And also, too, because my voice is rather high. I've been confused many times of being a female on the phone. They talk to me. I say, hello. They say, hello, Mrs. Bell. Is your husband there? Oh.
Wait, did you sing in falsetto?
Yeah, I'm a natural tenor. I don't have a falsetto. But I'm naturally high like that, so I hear high artists.
Well, let's hear another record that you arranged. And you're talking about the classical influence on your music because you were brought up playing classical music. Okay, so we're going to hear something from the Stylistics, which is another band that you work with. And this is the early 70s we're talking. Was it a group? Yeah, a band, right, yeah. Okay, so we're going to hear Betcha by Golly Wow, another song that you co-wrote. And this has a kind of long symphonic introduction. So before we hear it, I want to ask you, did you think that this would be a good thing, a long symphonic introduction? Or did you think, well, the soul music crowd might get a little impatient while this introduction is playing?
First place, there are areas of music that people do want to hear. I've had many people say, black people don't want to hear that, and black people don't do this, and black people don't do that. That's a misconception. And these were black people who were telling me, they don't want to hear that kind of music. Man, they're not interested. Well, I didn't believe that. It sounded good to me. So how the Betcha by Golly Wow came about. And meanwhile, in the history of songwriters, there have been many songs written, I love you, I love you, and there are a lot of different versions of those same words or any reasonable facsimile of those words. But there's only one Betcha by Golly Wow, only one in history. Only one, because I was the only one crazy enough to write something like Linda Creed and myself. And I came up with the Betcha by Golly Wow.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. It takes a nut to do something like
because
that.
Because she's a lyricist, so I was thinking
it was
her.
That's one of the rare times that she didn't write the lyric. I came up with it, and she looked at me like I was crazy. She said, Bella, you're nuts. And no one ever called her Linda. We always called her Creed. Listen to the idea, the concept of what I'm talking about. All of those words are words, are elements of express, of surprise. Golly, gee, wow, ooh. And the words similar like that, they were elements of expressions. So I wonder, can I put those together and to come up with a concept of writing with that? So that's where that came. So there were a twofold factor why that came about.
Did anyone say to you, those are corny expressions?
Of course. But over the years, I had learned never to let people hear my thoughts. It's like in The Godfather, my man told his son, he said, hey, what's wrong with you? You never let people know your thoughts. Well, I had been called whacked in the head as a child. And they wanted me, the teachers wanted me, the principal of the school wanted my mother to take me to the psychiatrist because he was a little kid, he hears music. And
You just heard music in your head.
I just heard in my mind, and I'm singing and tapping on things. They thought something was wrong with me. So I had learned to keep all those kinds of thoughts, even to this day, to myself. And you never know what lyric or melody is running through my mind.
Now, one more thing before we actually hear Betcha by Golly Wow. Is that an oboe in the beginning?
Yes, that's, let's see, was that an oboe? Was that Coin Glazy? That was an oboe. Corn Glaze is an English horn. I would intersperse the two, depending on the key.
Okay, well, let's hear Betcha by Golly Wow, co-written by my guest Tom Bell. He also arranged it, produced it, and conducted it.
And prayed for it. You name it, I did it.
Okay, big hit from 1972. And this is The Stylistics.
In your eyes, Candyland appears each time you smile. Never thought that fairy tales came true, but they come true when I'm near you. You're a genie.
That's The Stylistics, and the song was co-written, produced, arranged, and conducted by my guest, Tom Bell. You know, we talked about the oboe at the beginning there. What's the most unusual instruments that you've ever used?
Let me say this. Each instrument is designed for a specific kind of reaction that you're trying to get or a feeling that you're trying to relay. So when you say unusual, they all are unusual if you don't put them in the correct places where they're supposed to be. I think one of the most different instruments would be the andolin or the chitarrona. Those are Italian instruments that not too many people use. Ennio Morricone, the great conductor and the creator of stuff such as Good, Bad, and Ugly, A Fistful of Dollars, A Few Dollars More, The Untouchables, things of that nature. He was one of my inspirations, and I met him over in Milano, and Ennio Morricone introduced me to a few of those, like I say, the chitarrona, andolin. Those are different kind of instruments.
When you take a group like the Stylistics into the studio and you want them to get a sense of your concept for the sound of the record, how would you describe it to them? Would you sing them all their parts?
Yes. What I do, once I narrow that melody down, once I work on it until I cannot get any further, and Linda Creed, Old William Hart, or Denise Williams, or Phil Hurt, and the writers, but mostly Creed, would work on it and do their part. Work hard. We work real hard and hone it till it's pinnacle. It's apex. It's the top. It's sharp. It's at the best we can. Then I in turn bring the artists in and I explain the song to them. And then I sing the song to them. Now, once you know the song, once you sing the song and you get the concept in your mind of exactly what I wanted to do, I put it on tape for you. And they don't even hear the music until it's time to record. Once I bring them back in, I put them on the piano again. So they'll know exactly where to come. So when they hear that music, they're so ready. They're so charged. They're so energized. When they hear that music, that's my moment. That's when I know I've done the right thing. When they hear that music, and their eyes light up, and they just can't wait. They can't wait to add their part to it.
Well, Tom Bell, let's go a little deeper back into your career. Before we get to your work with Philadelphia International Records, let's start with some other Philadelphia-related work. And that is one of your first real major music jobs was conducting for Chubby Checker.
Ah, yes.
who, this was before or after he had his big hit, The Twist?
Oh, this was after.
This was after.
Not only did I conduct him, I was a songwriter for his company.
For Cameo Parkway?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, for his publishing
company. Oh, for his own company.
Yes, Chubby's. He had Evans Music, Evansville, one of the two. And I made $29 a week as a writer for his company.
Don't spend it all in one place.
No. I was scared.
So what was your job working with Chubby Checker?
Actually, I was a writer for his publishing company and also writing music for some of his shows and doing a little conducting for him.
And I think you were the house pianist for Cameo Parkway Records, which was a Philadelphia label that had a lot of hits with the hope of getting played on Dick Clark's American Bandstand, which, like the record label, was in Philadelphia. Working as a house pianist for a record label, did you learn things not only that you wanted to do when you got into the studio, but things that you did not want to do? Did you learn some of the wrong ways as well as the right ways?
What I did was, yes, I did. I learned, I watched. I watched the things that took a long time to do because things weren't prepared correctly. And I watched things that went smoothly because things were prepared correctly. And I learned that don't waste time in a studio. Waste time before you get to the studio where it doesn't cost anything. So if you're going to do anything, you practice, rehearse, get it all down pat, and put it on that paper so when you bring it to that studio, it's ready. It doesn't cost a lot of extra money to do things. And don't waste a lot of time. Wasting time is what costs a lot of money, and it gets boring.
Let's get to something that you're very well known for, which is your work for Philadelphia International Records, mm-hmm. which creates what became known as the Philly Sound, mm-hmm. label created by Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. And you were a key arranger in there. You met Gamble in a singing group, right? In the Romeos? You sang with his...
No, I met him before that.
Before that?
Yeah, my sister... I have a sister that was in his room in school, at high school. And she happened to help him do his homework. At least that's what they said.
I see where you're going.
He came in, and I was at the piano rehearsing. He said, "Hey, man, you play piano?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I write songs." I said, "That's great." He said, "My name is Kenny Gamble, and you're who?" "I'm Tommy Bell." That's what everyone knows me as Tommy, which was Tommy Bell all my life until I got big, and all of a sudden they said, "Well, let's change it to Tom Bell." "Okay, I don't care. As long as you don't call me too late for dinner. What the heck?" And so he said, "Maybe one day we can write together. Do you write too?" I said, "Yes, I have a couple of ideas." He said, "Maybe we can." And then, "Do you sing too?" "Yep." And he came by a couple of weeks later, and we started writing and singing, and away we went. In fact, we even made a record together called Someday.
So when he started the record label, he asked you to work there too?
Yes, I was working for another company, Philly Groove Records with the Delphonics at the time, and that I was leaving that situation because they were going in another direction, the company was, and I was going in another direction. So in 1970, after I did the last one with the Delphonics, which was Did Not Blow Your Mind this time, they asked me when I come down and help them form this company and do the music. I said, "Okay, I'll give it a shot. What the heck?" And so we started from there.
Did you have different resources when you were working for Philadelphia International than you did before that? Did you have more money to produce things? Did you have a bigger orchestra at your disposal, different kind of rhythm section?
Well, they had the rhythm section. What they would do, I was in the rhythm section. And that was when it was Baker Harris Young and Vince Montana and a few more, then Larry Washington and Bobby Eli and myself. And I was on piano, and Huff. And we were the rhythm section. So they were doing Jerry Butler at the time and Wilson Pickett and a few more of the artists. And then when it came time for me to do the sweet, what we call the sweetening, the strings and horns, things, I had a little bit bigger budget. Whereas when I started with in 1968, I would use 6 violins, 4 violins, 1 viola, 1 cello. When I got with them, I started using 9 violins, 4 violas, and a cello. And then as we grew and grew and grew, we got to be 18, 19, 20 violins, 6 violas, and 2 cellos. And you start using the contrabass. So yes, your pocketbook, your expenditures got bigger and your budget got bigger.
Composer, arranger, and producer Tom Bell speaking with Terry Gross in 2006. We'll hear more after a break. And we'll also have Justin Chang's film review of the sequel to A Quiet Place. Tom Bell was one of the architects of the Philly sound. Philadelphia International Records is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Here's a track he arranged in 1971. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
I've been down one time, and I've been down two times, but now I'm drowning, drowning in the sea of love. Let me tell you all about it. I've been out here so very long, I've lost all of my direction.
What happens to police officers who get caught stealing, lying, or tampering with evidence? Each week, we open up an internal affairs investigation that used to be secret to find out how well the police police themselves. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
This year marks the 50th anniversary of Philadelphia International Records, known as one of the originators of the Philly sound. Earlier this week, we heard from founders Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff. Now, we're listening back to our interview with one of the key architects of that sound, Tom Bell. He was an arranger for Philadelphia International Records and also wrote and produced hits by the Stylistics, the Spinners, and the Delphonics. Here's a song he co-wrote that became a big hit for the Stylistics in 1974.
Only you.
When you think of the Philly sound, what comes to your mind?
What comes to mind is cheesesteaks.
That's cheating.
And when I say cheesesteaks, I mean that there's only one place in the world that you can get a fantastic cheesesteak, and that's Philadelphia. And I don't care where you go, you can buy the mom and pop store on the corner, or you can buy Pat's, or you can go to any of the large places. They're all great cheesesteaks. And need some that's a little different. Some use shank, some use the butt, some use chuck, some use a rump roast. Something they all it's cut down real thin. Some use mozzarella cheese. Some use regular American cheese. Some you take some with lettuce and tomatoes on it. Some will take it with meatball sauce. But you can't beat a Philadelphia steak sandwich. And when you think of our PIR and our whole Philadelphia thing. We were a version of the steak sandwich, the only one of its kind. Now, you had great companies, but we were the only one like ourselves.
When you're asked to describe what the Philly sound means to you, can you break it down musically into something that you think is unique about those Philadelphia productions?
You can break it down musically into different modes of chord structures. Augmented and diminished, and major and minor chords. Other cities were doing the same. They were doing. See, there are 88 keys on a piano. Why is it that one can come and make it sound like one thing, another person can come along and make it sound like something else? But yet, it's the same 88 keys. The keys haven't changed. What has changed is the depth of field, the variations, and the feel of the person who's creating them. So our sound and what we did. Was a part of us. It's a part of you. It's part of what you. I always said it was something you felt, you smelt, or you dealt. Something you did, something you felt. So it's all part of you and what you see. For instance, real quick, one day when Cree and I couldn't come up with anything, we would just get up and walk out in the street. So we're walking down the street, bump to bump, we're looking around, because there's always something in the street to write about. There's always events. And I happened to see this guy. I was at Broad and Chestnut. And I saw this guy crossing. We were all crossing. And the guy stopped in the middle of the street and looked back. And he went a couple more. Then he looked back again. He's looking at this woman. And he called out this girl's name. Hey, so-and-so. I couldn't hear the name. And was chasing. And the girl looked at him like he was crazy. He said, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But he couldn't believe it wasn't who he thought it was. I was watching this. I said, Creed, I got it. I got an idea. Went back and wrote it. Today I saw somebody who looked just like you. So walked like you do. I thought it was you. As she turned the corner, I called out her name. I felt so ashamed when it wasn't you. I saw that because you're everything and everything. I saw that happen. It's like we saw that when people make the world around, a trash man didn't get my trash today. Those things happen. We were the kind of writers that we were very, we weren't abstract writers. And we were futuristic and very real. The things we wrote, very rarely did we write anything that was odd, things that were non-realistic.
I want to play what was one of the first big hits for Philadelphia International Records, and it's a record that you arranged, and it's the OJ's Backstabbers, which has a very dramatic introduction. Talk about the introduction that you put together for this record.
When they gave me the track, the tracks were done, the rhythm tracks were done already, and some of those things, the guitar parts, were in there, something like that. And what all I did was to broaden those things. And the beginning was what we call Misterioso. It's very mysterious, very dramatic. It had a very, when that thing hit, boy, it made you open your eyes. It made your ears open. It made your body say, whoa, what was that? And to me, I always felt that from the very beginning, from the first time he put the needle down, that's when they had records, of course, when he put the needle down on the record, it's supposed to say something. And when you're dealing with the civilian, dealing with the customer, what I call the civilians and customers, you give them something, when they're paying for something, give them your best, your best creative things. And from the very moment that needle goes down, you want it to be a memorable occasion. You wanted to grab them and say, whoa, what was that? And the next bar, each bar means something.
So what kind of mood did you want to hear and what kind of sound in that dramatic introduction?
Grandiose. I did, let's see, in the beginning that the strings were doing tremolandos and in the very beginning did a sweep, did a glissando with the harp. And I mean, that grabbed you. Dun, 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 dun. And it was meant to be that. You're talking about stabbing somebody in the back. Backstab. It's meant, whatever you're saying, the music had to walk hand in hand. They can't be talking about backstabbers, and you're writing Mary Had a Little Lamb. The two, everything has to match.
Well, it actually has a kind of action film sound to it.
Backstabbing is action. When you talk about, let me listen to the smile on your face. All the time they want to take your place. Those backstabbers, that's mysterious, man. That's dangerous stuff, boy. So you want the music to amplify what it is that they're talking about and what they're singing about.
Okay, here's the OJ's Backstabbers, arranged by my guest Tom Bell.
Thank you.
the OJ's big hit Backstabbers, a Philadelphia International Records hit, helped establish the record label. And my guest, Tom Bell, arranged that. And you're associated with the Philly sound. You moved to Philadelphia when you were about 5. You were born and spent the first 5 years of your life in Jamaica.
Yeah, that I was born in Kingston, Jamaica, but I was moved. My parents moved me here when I was about three or four years old.
Okay. Yes. So your parents were Jamaican.
Yes.
So did you feel culturally different when you were growing up?
Well, at times, because my mother talked funny, and my father. Most people never saw my father because he used to work 12, 14 hours a day. Culturally coming up, because I remember when the kids would meet my mother and look at me. What's wrong with your mother, man? What do you mean, what's wrong with my mother? Why she talk so funny? Hold it. They weren't used to hearing black people speaking like that, speaking the King's English in a certain kind of way. And so they thought something, what's wrong with that? Now you're going to fight. You don't talk about somebody's mother now. Hold it. What do you mean something wrong with her? Why she dress funny and stuff, man? What kind of family do you come from? And then you meet my grandfather, which is even worse. And he,
why? Why was he worse?
He would wear the top hat and wear the long coats and the boutonniere, which you call a flower in the lapel. And, oh, man. He was a doozy, and guys would really laugh at him.
He taught botany, didn't he?
Yeah, he was a botanist. He was a botanist and a horticulturist. He had 2 PhD degrees.
And what did your mother do?
Mother was actually, she was an executive secretary to one of the principal people at the university. She could type like 140 words a minute on a manual typewriter. She does not like electric, and she takes dictation.
So tell me, you grew up, your parents were Jamaican. Mm-hmm. You listened mostly to classical music until you were in your teens.
Yes.
So when you started producing soul music and rhythm and blues, did you feel like you had just like a different frame of reference than the singers and musicians, particularly the singers that you were working with?
I didn't know the difference. I don't know the difference. And they might have known the difference, but they didn't talk about it. They didn't say, well, what is this? They didn't say that because they were in the same boat. We were all coming up and had nothing together. We had nothing to lose because we were all poor together and we were all hungry together.
Were you poor when you were growing up? It sounds like your mother had a really decent job.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean anything because you have decent bills. Remember, there was a lot of us. There was 10 of us. So we didn't have the best of, let's put it like this. We didn't have the best of anything, but we had what we needed. I didn't have most of my clothes and things. I got them handed down from my older brothers. I don't think I had my own first pair of underwear, until I was about 18 or 19 when I started on my own because my brother was in the military. And so I thought everyone wore green underwear. That's military underwear. I didn't know. We had what we needed. We didn't have any extras, and we didn't know the difference. We did not know the difference because everybody in the neighborhood didn't have anything either. So we were all happy as a termite in a lumberyard.
We're listening to Terry's 2006 interview with Tom Bell, one of the architects of what became known as the Philly Sound. One of the labels behind that sound, Philadelphia International Records, is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org. Let's get back to your production and songwriting work. I want to play something that you did with the Spinners. Now, they had their first top 40 hit in 1961, but you were working with them in the 70s.
Yes.
What state was their career in when you started to work with them, and how did you get matched up?
Their career wasn't in great shape. At the time, I don't think the company that they were with, in fact, I know they had gotten rid of them. or they had left. Somewhere along the line, they part a company. Motown and them part a company, which is very easy to do. And you, when you come as, become as big as a CBS and Atlantic Records, you have so many artists, you don't really have the time to devote to every last artist. You have to have that amount of producers, that amount of arrangers, amount of everything, and things can slip through the cracks. So when I found them, they were on Atlantic Records, and Atlantic Records was going to get rid of them because they weren't a lot of times the companies want something that's going to make fast money, and a lot of times that's not what you're going to get. It takes time to build an artist, and they felt that they had spent a few dollars on them, very few. And when they sent me the list of artists that they had, I happened to see the very last page. It was like a typographical error that the word, all the artists were boom, 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 boom. They must have had 60, 70 artists. Last page, very last bottom of the page, I saw S-P-I-N. That's it. It was going off the page. I said, I wonder, are they those spinners that I used to play piano for at the Uptown Theater?
Oh.
So I called them and said, "But do you have the spinners from Motown?" They said, "Oh yeah, we can get rid of them." I said, "Please, whoa, don't get rid of them yet, because that's who I'd like to do." And when I got them, they didn't want to spend any money on them, so that they allowed me to do three songs. I said, "You know, I really like to do an album." "No, our budget doesn't call for that. We only want to do three songs." I said, "All right." I said, "Well, I think you're going to be sorry." And, of course, later on they were sorry because they had only had three songs, and now they had two number ones out of the crowd and didn't have an album. They lost money.
Before we hear the Spinners, I have to ask you, this is the era where a lot of rhythm and blues groups are wearing orange jumpsuits and the big hats and the big hair with the big bushy sideburns and gold medallions. And, you know, what'd you think of that? Did you ever dress that way? And what did you think of that as stage clothing? Did it work for you?
I never paid attention to it. I never dressed.
How could you not pay? It's so unmissable.
My mind, I'm a weird guy. My mind is on music all the time. And the things that most people see, I don't even see. I don't pay attention to it. I don't pay attention to the shoes, the socks, the sound, the style, the lingo. I just don't pay attention to it. It doesn't affect me. I don't hear it.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for asking me to come. It's been my pleasure coming back to Philadelphia and sitting with you guys. WHYY used to be at 46 and Market.
That's right.
Dick Clark and the boys. I remember those days a long time ago.
Composer, arranger, and producer Tom Bell, one of the architects of the Philly sound. Philadelphia International Records is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Here's the Spinners' 1972 hit, which he co-wrote. Justin Chang reviews the sequel to John Krasinski's hit horror film, A Quiet Place. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With no fees or minimums on checking and savings accounts, banking with Capital One is the easiest decision. Kind of like Taylor Swift choosing a cardigan on a chilly day. And with their top-rated app, you can deposit checks and transfer money anytime, anywhere, making Capital One an even easier decision. That's banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
As movie theaters reopen nationwide, the horror film A Quiet Place Part II already has become one of the summer's early box office hits. It's a sequel to John Krasinski's 2018 film, A Quiet Place, in which Krasinski and Emily Blunt played survivors of a deadly alien apocalypse. Our film critic, Justin Chang, has this review.
In the sensational 2018 thriller, A Quiet Place, humanity has been ravaged by hideous alien predators with extraordinary powers of hearing. The story follows the Abbotts, a family of survivors who must stay quiet at all times, unable to talk or sneeze or step on a creaky floorboard, or they'll likely be dead. It was a killer word-of-mouth hook. Here was a movie you had to watch in a theater in your own state of silence, with no slurping or popcorn crunching allowed. A Quiet Place became a huge success, and its filmmaker and star, John Krasinski, wrote and directed a sequel that was supposed to open last March. But then the COVID-19 pandemic forced theaters to close, and the movie's release was postponed. Now, more than a year later, theaters have reopened, and A Quiet Place Part II is drawing large audiences. Is it too soon to go back to theaters, with the pandemic not yet fully subsided? I wondered as much when I watched the film at a recent media screening. I felt pretty safe. I was wearing a mask in a nearly empty theater and had been fully vaccinated weeks earlier. But I also felt privileged to be seeing a film on a big screen with strict precautions in place. Whether you go to see it now or wait until it begins streaming, A Quiet Place Part II is likely to make you a little jumpy. It doesn't have the same claustrophobic intensity as its predecessor, but it's just as taut, suspenseful, and beautifully made. As before, Krasinski doesn't explain why the aliens are here in the first place, but he does give us an opening flashback to the terrible day they arrived, laying waste to the Abbott's small town in upstate New York, and other towns and cities all over the globe. Many people die, but the Abbotts survive, mainly because they're quick to realize that the monsters hunt by sound. Then the movie flashes forward many months, picking up right after the events of the first film. Krasinski's character, Lee Abbott, has been tragically killed, leaving behind his wife, Evelyn, played by a fierce Emily Blunt, and their three children. Krasinski and Blunt are married in real life. The family is shaken but resilient. They finally discover the alien's fatal weakness, and they're curious about making contact with other survivors. And so they set out from their farmhouse and make their way across an overgrown post-apocalyptic landscape, where danger lurks around every corner. In this nearly wordless scene, which conveys the movie's layered sound design, Evelyn accidentally triggers a booby trap, causing a loud clatter. The fact that the characters can't speak out loud is one reason the Quiet Place movies are so effective. Not being able to fall back on verbal exposition has forced Krasinski to become a ruthlessly efficient visual storyteller. It's often said that Alfred Hitchcock's movies are so sharply directed you could turn the sound off and still follow the action, a truth that applies to these movies as well. It helps that the Abbotts are fluent in American Sign Language, since their oldest child, Reagan, is deaf, as is the actor who plays her, the remarkable Millicent Simmons. As in the first film, Reagan emerges as the story's truest hero. She's tough, courageous, and determined to help as many other people as she can. Less eager to take action is her traumatized younger brother, Marcus, heartbreakingly played by Noah Jupe. Eventually, the Abbotts take temporary shelter in an abandoned steel factory, where they reunite with an old family friend, Emmett, played by a grave Killian Murphy. Emmett is grieving the loss of his family and has become deeply cynical about humanity, at one point saying, "The people that are left, they're not worth saving." Reagan disagrees. "Not only are people worth saving," she says, but if enough of them joined forces, they might be able to fight back against the aliens. The movie seems to think they both have a point. As Reagan and Emmett embark on a perilous journey in search of survivors, they find themselves in situations that give rise to both hope and despair. Some of the people they meet are as predatory as the monsters. Others are as brave and compassionate as Reagan. That makes A Quiet Place Part II an unexpectedly resonant film for the present moment, as this country slowly emerges from a crisis that, while surely less terrifying than an alien apocalypse, has revealed humanity at its best and its worst. The movie ends on an inconclusive note, leaving the door open for another sequel, which is both frustrating and heartening. I'm already looking forward to finding out what happens next, hopefully in a dark theater, watching as quietly as I can.
Justin Chang is the film critic for the LA Times. On Monday's show, actress, singer, dancer Rita Moreno. She's most famous for her role as Anita in the 1961 film adaptation of West Side Story, a tough nun and prison psychologist in the HBO series Oz, and more recently, co-starring in the reboot of the Norman Lear sitcom One Day at a Time. She's the subject of an upcoming PBS American Masters documentary. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support by Joyce Lieberman, Julian Hertzfeld, and Mike Villers. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.